Today on The Grave Talks, Living with the Dead, a conversation with Frank Sinelli. Everyone sees their imaginary friends, right? That's what Frank Sinelli thought for many years, until he realized that was not the norm. This and several other childhood experiences involving the dead would lead him on a path of trying to understand the dead better and seek answers. Frank's experiences are utterly unique, from being part of an accidental exorcism to removing a haunted painting from a home and much more. Today on The Grave Talks, we hear his story.
You know, after talking about this for years and years and years, paranormal apparently has always been a part of my life. I remember as a young child, maybe 4 or 5, I had an imaginary friend. Oh, okay, there's nothing weird about that, mm-hmm. Except he was all gray with blonde hair. Who knows? The other thing that was odd about my imaginary friend was his name was McTavish. Now, to preface this, I grew up in an all-Italian community. I didn't know somebody's name couldn't end in a vowel until I was in my teens.
Sure.
So I have no idea where that name came from, but it was weird. He wouldn't leave the house. He wouldn't, like if we were going to the grocery store, he wouldn't come. And I would have like these long, in-depth conversations with McTavish. Mm-hmm. So that was like the first memory of something being weird that I have. Then, of course, as I grew older, I always had this interest. I remember I was about 9. I'm the youngest of 5. And my sister at that time was, like everybody else, was into doing seances and cool things like that. So at 9 years old, I joined her in a seance in the downstairs bathroom of my parents' house. So there's probably 6 of us in there. It was like a big powder room kind of thing. We're doing the seance, and they're trying to contact a local doctor who had just died. Now, I had never met this man in my life. Didn't know, couldn't pick him out from Adam. I saw his face in the mirror, and I was able to describe him down to his little round wireframe glasses.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a significant paranormal event. And it's funny, we were at a wedding a couple years ago, and one of my sister's friends was there. And that subject came up, and she was like freaking out still. And this is probably going back 40 years or so. I'm not that old. Oh, yeah, I guess I am that old. Anyway, and she still freaks out over that, how I saw him in her boyfriend, her husband now, he saw him too. So yeah, we were kind of tripping on that for a little bit. And then as I got older, I would read everything I could possibly get my hands on about paranormal. You name it, I read it. I wanted to read it. The other big thing that really kind of drove me home with this was In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy.
Sure.
That just like, wow, I didn't know all this stuff existed. And I'd start researching more. And it was hard. I mean, small town in Pennsylvania, your public library does not have a big metaphysical section. And of course, nowadays research is like, I could sit in my easy chair and research with my thumb.
Yeah.
So it was hard. Going forward, we started messing around with Ouija boards and things like that. And I remember one time we were doing the Ouija board at my parents' house, my one friend and I. And we asked, okay, what is our other friend Dave doing? And whoever we were talking to said, shower. All right. So it's like we say goodbye, go to the landline, right? Rotary phone, call him up. Dave, what are you doing? He's like, I just got out of the shower. So that was kind of cool. We talked to one spirit who said he was Keith Moon. you know, I don't know if the drummer from The Who, mm-hmm. who had recently died. You know, that one I question because things got a little weird going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And paranormal kind of came in and out of my life for a while after that. Of course, always around the fall, everybody wants to do spooky things, and we would go investigate or just kind of hang out in abandoned buildings. And, you know, not that I'm an advocate of breaking and entering, but, you know, we did what we did.
Sure.
And that was cool. But, you know, then other things, interests, girls, sports, you know,
yeah.
There's only so much time one guy has.
Yeah. Life kind of starts to take over and then it kind of, you know, those interests start to fade. And for many, it kind of comes back later. We'll get to that in just a little bit. But I want to go back and kind of unpack some of the things that you talked about before we get too far ahead of ourselves.
Sure.
Let's talk about the imaginary friend initially. Obviously, you know, you have an imaginary friend. Other kids talk about having imaginary friends. But when was it for you that you realized most people don't see their imaginary friends?
I didn't realize that till later in life.
Okay.
Honest to goodness.
That's a lot of people. Yeah.
This was normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we didn't really talk about it much.
Sure.
I talk about my friend and, you know, and I'd say, well, mom, he's sitting right over there. You know, the mom would do the pleasant little mom thing. And like, oh, you know, and try to address an empty chair. Oh, would you like some spaghetti too?
Mm-hmm. And she's she's just trying to humor you. And you're like, yeah, he's right there. He's gray, but he's there. And when you're a kid, everything is new to you. And so it's like, oh, well, this must just be how this is. You know, you don't question the absurdity of it how not common this sort of thing is. When was there a moment where you realized, was there like a conversation you had with somebody where you were talking about your imaginary friend and you're like describing him in detail and somebody's like, dude, like, I never saw my imaginary friends. Like, what do you mean he looked like that?
Yeah, no, that wasn't till later in life. As I was getting older, my dad told me I had to tell McTavish to leave.
Okay.
So I said, all right, buddy, it's dad says we can't play anymore. You got to go,
mm-hmm.
you know, something like that. And then I never saw him again after that.
Sure. How was that? I mean, because you're just going through life processing this as, you know, people see their imaginary friends. It is what it is. How did you process that when somebody pointed out people don't normally see their imaginary friends as later in life, as when you had that moment?
Yeah, it was a what the heck moment.
Yeah.
It's like, no, really? You didn't see your imaginary friend? Or it's not everybody's friend is visible.
Mm-hmm.
It was confusing. It was like, what the
You can
heck?
Swear. Go for it.
Oh, okay.
Don't worry.
You know, sometimes I'm allowed to, sometimes I'm not.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. But yeah, I'm like, what the fuck? And it was that shock, that moment of shock. It's like I was actually hanging out with a ghost.
Yeah. Did you immediately go to ghost? Did you immediately think, oh my God, that was a ghost? Okay.
Yeah. I have no idea why, but
sure.
It's like, yeah.
And the name McTavish, obviously, it's not a very it's not an Italian sounding name at all, because it's not an Italian name. So what?
No.
So where, you know, as you have this realization that, OK, this imaginary friend was not just in my imagination. Did you do any research? Did you look into this at all to try and find anything about the name McTavish and maybe that area of where you grew up? You know, maybe generationally there was, you know, other immigrants there, another, you know, family from, you know, different lineage that had kind of populated that area at one time?
No, we had our three towns. Right?
Okay.
So there's Bangor, and that was mostly Welsh.
Okay.
McTavish is not a common Welsh name.
Okay.
Then you have Penardral, which was predominantly English.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And again, now McTavish is more of a Scottish name.
Yeah.
So there were none in our area.
how bizarre, because you'd almost think, oh, yeah. Well, maybe, you know, years and generations ago, you know, there was, you know, Scottish family there, or maybe that was, you know, predominantly Scottish at one point. But so there was nothing that made sense for them to, for him to be there geographically, I guess. Is that what you're saying?
None. Yeah, none at all. So I live in an area, it's called the Slate Belt. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you know, for years, that was our main industry, you know, slate, roofs, pool tables, blackboards,
sure,
that kind of thing. And you know, again, the three towns, that we had Rosetto, the Italian town, Bangor and Panargol. And most everybody worked for one of the slate companies way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Interesting. So we've never really found any reason. There's no inklings. There's no little breadcrumbs at all that you can put together on this one at all. It's just kind of a mystery to you as to why he was there. Is that where your mind is still at with it?
There may have been a family, mm-hmm. you know, but I've never found any record of it.
Interesting. Oh. I had a conversation like this on the air once with my ex-wife. She had a very similar experience with her imaginary friend. And we actually had the realization on the air on our other show, Real Ghost Stories Online. We were talking about imaginary friends and such. And it was like, no, people don't see their imaginary friends. And that was just kind of interesting. And it was, I forgot the name, but it was the only pieces that we could put together, because the child looked very much like someone out of the early 1900, or like 1910, 1920-ish. There had been a large school explosion in Texas, which is where this took place, around that time. And a lot of the bodies had been actually transported via train and via rail after this explosion. And this rail line ran directly through her backyard. And still was a rail line at the time. And that was the only thing that we could put together. But very similar, where, you know, they played for a while and eventually had to move on and go somewhere else. But I think a lot of people...
You've just given me a good idea.
What's that?
So we're not that far from, like, the coal region in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there were a lot of Scottish immigrants there. And children would work in the mines, and he was dressed from that area. He had overalls, and he always wore like one of those caps.
Yeah.
I forget the name of those, but yeah. So, and again, the railroad connects all of us.
I wonder if there's a connection there.
I know what I'm doing tonight.
You got to look at all the things. It's not always just geographics about where they live. It's like, well, where would they have traveled? Why would have someone gone along these lines? Accidents, of course, very, very common at that day. Children mortality, absolutely horrible at that point in time. So there is a very strong likelihood that something could have happened along the rail line or something, you know, where that's just kind of where he ended up. Interesting. What were your parents' opinions of your imaginary friend and your interests and your family's interest, your siblings' interest in having seances and trying to communicate with ghosts and all of that? Were they accepting of it, or is it just kind of like, oh, kids will be kids? How did they handle that when you were a child?
It was kind of like kids will be kids, and they just kind of brushed everything under the table. Then, you know, if you try to talk about it, they didn't want to talk about it. But, you know, apparently this kind of thing went on. Like my grandmother, right? So my grandmother apparently was very intuitive, and people would come to her for answers to questions, and but we never talked about it. I found this out long after she had passed. Otherwise, I'd be like, Graham, I got a billion questions. Mm-hmm. Why don't you help me?
Sure.
You know, there's the evil eye, the maloch, you know, which my grandmother could do. It's like, you know, she would do the thing. And you know, when you kind of look at it, it's almost like doing a spell or something like that, where, mm-hmm. where you can detect if somebody has given you the evil eye and she could remove it. So, but again, we never talked about that. She talked to my sister about it a little bit and taught my sister how to do it. But that's it. You could only learn to do it at midnight on Christmas Eve.
Really?
So, yeah. It's one of those things. Now, my sister taught my son how to do it.
Explain this to me a little bit. What exactly, you know, when I hear the word evil eye, all I think is someone like just giving a child a dirty look or something, a dirty look. Explain it in detail.
In paranormal terms, we refer to these as like a thought form possession.
Okay,
where someone is you're really angry at someone and you know, you have nothing but bad will for them. And this is a negative energy, which sometimes can take on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now this is attached to that person, and that person starts to feel things, or the person has a run of bad luck, or it's almost like a precursor to oppression.
Okay. So this is, and this is essentially, you're taking energy from yourself, negative energy from yourself, and basically transposing it onto someone by giving not just a dirty look, but that look comes with energy that is basically projected onto that individual. Is that, am I understanding correctly?
Exactly. It's thought form possession. We could actually do it to ourselves too. You know, if you're a person who tends to be extremely angry all the time,
mm-hmm.
you create this negative energy around yourself.
Okay.
Now, initially it all comes from you or somebody else, but at some point it literally takes on a life of its own and then starts to draw in more negative energy.
And that's an interesting thing, because I've talked a lot in this last year about energy and us almost being able to haunt ourselves with our own energy, you know, anxiety, depression. There's so much that everyone has been feeling in this last year, and just almost kind of manipulating our environment unintentionally, lights turning on and off, things happening, not necessarily a full-blown apparition sitting in front of us or someone else, but just things happening that otherwise wouldn't be because of just pent up, you know, anxiety, depression, all those things. When you're talking about this of it creating a life of its own, how does that work? What is your opinion on that? Is it something where it's then drawing in a conscious entity that's out there, almost like a beacon? Here's the lighthouse, here's the energy, come on in, and then you can kind of take this over, or something else can take that over? Or is it literally creating a new consciousness that is able to do things?
No, it's not creating a new consciousness. It's more the lighthouse effect.
Okay.
Here's a chink in the armor. Let me attack there.
Okay.
And again, a lot of this depends on your spiritual belief.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there are different ways to word the same thing. So I'm just going to go with what I know,
yeah,
which is a Christian background. So when your energy is high, okay, you're virtually impervious. When, you know, life is good, you eat well, you're exercising, you're a very positive person, this makes it hard for negative to attach. Okay.
Sure.
So now when you start to get down or get that anxiety or the depression, which, I mean, that stuff is on the rise. I can tell you stories about that. But it lowers your vibrational level. When your vibrational level becomes lower, now you're open.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've got a weak spot. Okay, and these things, whether you want to call them demonics or parasiticals or whatever you want to call them, they're opportunists. Okay, they will jump at the chance to bring you further down. Okay, so it starts with an attachment. Okay, and that attachment just starts to put you further into this downward spiral.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes from attachment into oppression. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now things are getting pretty bad and you know, you're just can't see a way of digging yourself out of a hole, whatever. And then that eventually leads to possession.
So it's this step-by-step process, but you can almost, if you have very ill intent, can almost begin that process and hopefully the other person, depending on what you want for them, either they are able to snap out of it and bring themselves up and kind of push that away, or it can be the catalyst for a large downfall.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And I mean, a lot of the people in the paranormal can recognize when this is happening,
mm-hmm.
and they'll, you know, seek out somebody who works with energy.
Sure.
And that can help break that that curse, so to speak.
Okay.
It's not really a curse, but
sure. I mean, it's just very interesting to hear that perspective on it. Once you had, you know, you'd gone through, you know, the childhood years, the teenage years of all that, being interested in this stuff, and then you kind of get into life a bit, and then you're drawn back into it a bit later in life. What drew you back into to want to investigate this more, that to research it more, and to make it a part of your life as an adult?
Okay, so it wasn't too much later that I got back into it. It's when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
You know, joined a fraternity. My roommate was into it just as much as I was. As a matter of fact, he taught me how to do EVP.
Okay.
Our fraternity house was across the street from a cemetery. Right? Our fraternity house, that was wild. It was a church, then it was a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center,
wow.
And then it became our fraternity house.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, there was a lot of energy going on in there. But my friend Danny taught me how to do EVPs. And we would go over, like on a Thursday night, right? Everybody's doing pub night. Us two weirdos are sneaking over to the cemetery with an old reel-to-reel recorder doing EVPs.
Yeah.
So, hey, you know, we got some stuff there. It was kind of cool. Looking back, and I wish I still had those tapes because I'd like to review them again. With what I know now.
Sure. What was everyone's opinion of the house and its energy? Obviously a fraternity, several people there. Was it just you two that really felt it was haunted, or did everyone feel that there was something going on there?
Believers, non-believers, everybody had an experience there. There was one day, right? There's a long hallway, rooms on either side, and in the middle of the hallway is the shower room. At the end of the hallway is an office. So I'm sitting in the office. I got the window open up and I'm typing a paper. And one dude comes running out of the bathroom, looks at me, says, "What the hell were you doing?" I'm looking at him like, "What do you mean? I've been in here typing."
Mm-hmm.
"You weren't just in here. You didn't start rubbing my head." I'm like, "No, man, no. Even if I was, you know I'm not fast enough to get from here to there."
Yeah.
So he was white as a ghost. This dude, you know, fearless in every other aspect of his life,
mm-hmm.
Scared shitless.
What were some of the other experiences that took place in that fraternity house that really kind of made everyone go, "Oh my God, there's definitely stuff here"? Because I can only imagine you telling me how many things it had been, the rehab center and such. That's just seeming like a battery for many things.
You know, it's we've had the stereo system turn on several times in the middle of the night. And then it wasn't consistent. So it wasn't like, okay, yeah, it's a loose wire or a bad switch or something. And it wasn't just one switch. I mean, you had to, I think there's like four switches and you had to plug the amplifier in.
Yeah.
And yet it came on several times. There'd be, of course, you know, the footsteps and things being moved, things being lost and then found in a spot that it really shouldn't be in. So,
does the building,
you know,
I was going to say, does the house still exist to this day?
No, it burned to the ground.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, my next question was going to be, have you ever been able to go back and ask any current members if it's still an active fraternity, if they have anything going on there now?
No. I mean, as I understand it, it was active up until it burned to the ground.
Wow. With the cemetery.
I don't think the haunting was part of the fire.
Though. No.
I believe that was just negligence on some drunken sophomore's part.
Sure, which that does happen. The cemetery that was across the street from it, let's talk about cemeteries in general for a moment. They're mm-hmm. obviously, everyone kind of has their opinion on them. Some will claim, oh, there's nothing in them because it's not a place, you know, most normal people visit other than people like us. Or unless you're there for, you know, a funeral and such. Others will say, yeah, they're super big hotspots for activity. What's your belief on cemeteries and them being, you know, hot areas of activity for the dead?
It's not one of my favorite things to do is investigate a cemetery. But every time I have, there's always something.
Okay.
There's always something. We did, and I'm part of the Ghost Detectives. It's a local Pennsylvania TV show.
Okay.
So we did a show. We filmed the show at Hanover Green Cemetery up in Coal Country in PA. And there's a body chute, right? So okay. The body chute obviously is where they would store bodies until the ground thawed so they can dig them out.
Yep.
So we each took turns spending a little time in the body chute, and we were doing a Facebook Live at the time. And I'm in there, right? And the guy that's supposed to come get me forgot. So now I'm stuck in this body chute for, you know, an hour plus. And I could hear growling, and people on the Facebook Live could hear the growling and scratching on the chute. And I mean, you know, it was a little intense. I was like, hey, if any of you has Bob's number, call him, tell him to come get me. So that's it. By the way, that just went on Amazon Prime, Ghost Detectives.
All right. So what's going through your mind as you're in there and you're feeling, you know, this presence, you're hearing growling, you're hearing scratching, no one's coming to get you. Are you feeling, okay, nothing really is going to be able to get me? Or is this just a scare thing? I mean, what's going through your mind emotionally as you're having this experience?
Well, my thought, first of all, I don't like closed in space. Mm-hmm. So I'm already a little hinky from that. My first thought was, this has got to be some kind of animal,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying to get in, maybe a mouse, a rat, or something. And that's freaking me out worse than the possibility that this could be a ghost,
mm-hmm.
To be honest with you. I am typically not afraid when I investigate. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will take things seriously and cautiously, depending on the severity of the haunting. But yeah, I don't go from a fear base.
Mm-hmm.
You really can't, because again, that's a chink in your armor. It's you got to spiritually protect yourself, energetically protect yourself, and you'll be fine.
So why is it, you said earlier that cemeteries are not typically your favorite place to visit, yet you do seem to have experiences there whenever you go to them? Why are they not one of your favorite places to visit?
Because I find it a little disrespectful.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things I kind of go back and forth on. This is a place where they're to be honored and remembered, you know, not bothered with, what is your name? When did you die? Do you know what year it is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So it was, I mean, overall, that cemetery was a really interesting spot. There was a chapel there that we investigated, and there was like stuff moving and knocks and direct responses. So,
what's your opinion on where activity occurs? Are you more likely to have things happen that cannot be explained outdoors, like in a cemetery setting, or is it more likely to be in a setting of a structure, a building, a chapel, a house, something where many events may have taken place within four walls and a roof?
Huh. That's a good question. I've never thought of that before. I would say you're more likely in a structure because there's more in the structure that will hold energy, or, you know, that special thing someone's attached to. Or, like you said, many more events have happened, you know, mm-hmm. in this house.
More confined.
So, yeah, I think the energy would be greater in a confined structure than, you know, than an outdoor spot. Now, that being said, there are exceptions. You know, there are like these sacred spots that tend to be convergences of ley lines, which have a higher amount of activity and a higher amount of energy.
Let me ask you this. Have you ever gone into an investigation where you knew what you were walking into was dark, but you felt this is going to take a lot of strength to not show that fear, to not have that kink in your armor, if you will, because what you're being told, what you're learning about is pretty intense?
Yeah, I have been in that situation several times. and, you know, not something that I openly, actively seek out, but kind of something within the past 2 years, it's like every other case that we get is becoming very dark and darker and darker. And there's a lot of different theories on that. Mm-hmm. One of the theories is because of the TV shows, this dark stuff has become glamorized, mm-hmm. you know, and people are doing more summoning and so on and so forth. So yeah, people are bringing this stuff upon themselves. You know, the other thought too is just the world energy, and that was so prevalent this past year with the global pandemic. Mm-hmm. It's a game changer, you know. And you had alluded to it earlier that people are having more stuff happen. And you know, initially I always debated, well, is there more stuff happening, or are people just home now and they notice it more?
Yeah,
you know, but that changed rapidly to, yeah, no, this is the world gone nuts, man.
That's going to wrap up part one of our conversation with Frank Sinelli. On part two of our conversation, has he ever had an investigation where he knew that he was going to be walking into a very dark situation and felt it would take a lot of strength to not show fear? Why does Frank believe that investigations are becoming darker and darker today? What was the history of the painting that would not burn? Why does Frank never want to be part of an exorcism again? And are animals the ultimate ghost detector, and why don't investigators use them more often during investigations? We'll discuss all that and more in part two. To hear it, become a gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. Sign up, patreon.com/thegravetalks, to get access to all of our interviews, part one and part two in their entirety, as well as our advanced episodes weeks, months before the release to the public. All of it is commercial free, and your support is what keeps us on the air. It's only $5 a month to get access to all of that. Patreon.com/TheGraveTalks, or go to our website, thegravetalks.com, and click Become a Gravekeeper. And a big thank you to you if you're supporting the program. We could not do this without you. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.